Welcome to Casa de Cambio. On this episode of Casa de Cambio podcast, I am so excited to be joined all the way from the United States. Nigel Thurlow, welcome to the podcast, Nigel.
Hey, Tash, thanks for having me. I appreciate you.
How's your week going?
Tiring, exhausting, just getting out of a jet lag, as you did earlier with some extensive travel, but I'm getting my head back into this thing we call work.
I'm glad to hear it. Speaking of travel, I'm so excited that you've agreed to come onto the podcast because I saw your presentation at the World Agility Forum back in end of September, I think it was. And not only did I laugh my ass off, but I thought you said some really, really insightful, well, we needed it. Insightful things about Agile. So we're going to talk about Agile transformations and why they fail. But before we get into that topic, there's a couple of questions I ask every guest who comes onto the podcast. And the first one is, what are you currently watching, reading, or listening to?
Oh, watching was a really good thing. I just watched an Idris Elba thing on Apple TV this week. Binge watched that.
I've heard something that's really good.
Trying to think what it was called. I was on a plane or something, and there was some hijacking, and that was pretty. It was pretty good actually. It turned out quite well in the end. Reading, believe it or not, and I'm not doing self-promotion. I'm still reading the book we've just released, not because I want to promote the book, because I'm trying to remember everything we wrote. We're still trying to find errors and omissions in it and any mistakes. So, and I wish I had more time to do more reading. I came back from 28 days of travel, including Lisbon, where we met, and a bunch of other things. And I thought, right, I've got this whole, because I keep ordering books. I'm one of these people, I order books as I see them.
Yep.
And other authors kindly give me books as I try and force one of mine onto them, and then I go, I'm going to read all these books, and most of these books end up as reference books in research. I never get the actual time to read them, but I am going to try and make an earnest effort over the winter holidays to because your summer, our miserable cold winter now in Texas, to actually to read some of these books and learn something that I probably don't already know.
I'm the same. I have a huge book debt, and I buy books and books of my colleagues and friends, but also if I have someone on the podcast, and I will have to preface this by saying I haven't read your book because it's scared, the size of it scares me, but I will get around to it. But I usually try and read the book of someone who's coming onto the podcast before, so then those books get prioritized, and all the fiction books, all the fun stuff kind of, so my coffee table has about 25 books on it at the moment.
Oh, I haven't read fiction since I was a kid. I've just had no time for that, but it's not that I don't like it, I just have no time for it. But I like the phrase book debt. I just literally wrote it down, and I'll remember that phrase. That's a good one. But the book we just put out isn't a reading book, and that's the scary thing. So all 703 pages of it, more on the Kindle, but it's actually a study guide and a reference book. It's actually meant that my advice to anybody who picks it up, and there are some people who've got it in Australia, I know for a fact, because I'd sent some over there. But anybody who picks it up, read the preface and the introduction, read the lean thinking section, which is just my way of fixing all the misnomers and BS on LinkedIn and everything else about what lean and TPS really is at the deep roots of it. And that was co-written with John Shook, ex-Toyota Lean Institute guy. And then after you've read that, which these are very short, that's like an hour. Read the preface, the introduction, the lean thing, it's an hour, you're done. Then read the introduction to each section, complexity thinking, distributed leadership, team science. Give it 30 minutes for each of those. And then read the conclusion. Now, the rest of the book is when you want to learn the things that are in the book that might be useful to you. Value stream mapping, organizational design, I know, Wardley mapping, Kinevin or something like that. Oh, I need to know about Kinevin. Well, there's a section on that. And then you go dip in, and in between these pages, there's 400 pictures. So 400 visuals based on a lot of my slide material. And on top of that, there's 41 worksheets with QR codes you can download free of charge from the website. So when you take all the pictures out and the worksheets out and the index and the table of figures, table of contents out, there's actually only about 300 pages of text. So it actually becomes a small book. It just looks overwhelming.
No, that's good. You've just broken it down into some manageable chunks. Thank you. I'm less scared of it now. The second question I ask guests is, what is the best piece of career advice you ever received?
It's not that, I don't know about what I've ever received, but if I was giving myself career advice now, I would never have got into corporate life. And I actually sat with somebody at the World Agility Forum and said, he asked me the similar question, and I said, get out of corporate life, go do something else, much more interesting, much more, stop wasting your life trying to argue with a bunch of idiots that don't want to listen. And my problem in the later years is they hire me, they bring me in, you're a consultant, they bring you in, and they ask you for their advice, and you do all this cool stuff. We do some cool, use some cool tools like sense making and things to discover what's going on in the organization. And then we present that, and then they argue with me why I'm wrong. And then we fight.
And then they don't take the advice, and they keep making the same mistakes.
Or they hire me to fix it, or my team to go in and fix it, because I've got to the point where I can't be bothered to fix it anymore. And the reality is, I can't fix anything. You can't fix anything. The only people that can fix it are the people who run the system that you're helping them to fix. So you can elucidate, illuminate, you can reveal where the problems are, you can show them where the issues are, you can demonstrate them in multiple different ways, lots of different techniques, training and other things, but they have to choose to be willing to change. It's like, you know, if somebody wanted to give up eating too much or give up drinking too much or give up smoking.
You need to want to change.
You've got to want to do it. And that means the leadership being participatory and engaged. And if they're not, it'll just fail, because you're always going to hit that sort of block at some point that says, nah, change is for somebody else. You know, most executives believe, yeah, we want change, but that means everybody else,
but not me. Not me.
Yeah,
no,
I'm fine.
No.
And so if I was doing it all over again, I'd never, ever go into corporate life whatsoever. And it's not about the money. It's about your quality of life and how you've, I mean, I just turned 61. So I'm feeling particularly old now. I mean, I may look younger, but I'm feeling particularly old. So I'm thinking, how much more of my life am I going to waste arguing with people who suffer from the Peter principle? And your listeners can Google that for a giggle.
They know what it is. We've talked about it. Yeah.
Okay, fair enough then. Yeah. So, so that's really what I would say. There's lots of things I'd much rather have done. And I would really seriously consider it. And when I was in the Netherlands, after Lisbon, I did South Africa and then went to the Netherlands, weird set of trips. And I sort of got asked by Scrum Master, I did a keynote there, and I was sort of talking about a topic we'll no doubt get onto, the bullshit jobs topic. And I had a Scrum Master come up at the end of the day and the conference and say, okay, so my job's bullshit, what do I do? And my advice, and I've been giving this to a few Scrum Masters, and it's a pertinent thing, because in the US, these huge swathes of job culling at the moment going off. Scrum Masters are getting, same in Oz as well. Yeah. And part of it, because the US financial year runs January to December, not like the screwy British one, which goes sort of, and you know, April to April, whatever it is in the UK. I haven't lived there for so many years. And if you get rid of people before the end of the year, you're not required to pay bonuses for this year in the pay packets next year. Where if they roll into January 1st, any bonuses are payable. So if you cut them before the end of the year, get away with that paying them bonuses. Now, of course, that's not the reason they're really doing that. Although I just know a bunch of people have got their termination date for December the 29th. So spookily close to that. And but they have been laid off as Scrum Masters because their management no longer see value in the role. Yep. And that's coincidental to what I was talking about in Lisbon and in the Netherlands. And this guy came and says, what am I going to do? And I said, well, is Scrum the only thing you can do? And he says, no, I did all these things. And I said, I know all these other things. I said, well, you need to rewrite your resume and re-promote or rebrand yourself as all these things you know, whether it's change, project management, process improvement, lean, whatever, whatever, whatever. Yeah. Oh, and by the way, I also am pretty good at Scrum and some of this agile stuff, if that's important to you. But I have this wide toolbox that I'm very good at. I'm not a Scrum Master or an Agile coach, because they're dying breeds.
I'm an Agile PM.
Yeah.
I'm an Agile project manager. I'm an Agile change manager.
The latest misery that seems to be coming out is the Agile manager. And that's an anathema and the antithesis to the whole idea. And I'm waiting to see what an Agile manager, basically a delivery manager with the word Agile stuck on the front, because it sounds good.
Yeah. No, I think that's great advice. And that's something I feel like you just stepped inside my brain and took a little look around, because, you know, when I was a kid, I thought being a high-flying business person was so glamorous. And, you know, when you get into that, so I, in my early career, I worked for a big consulting company, and you travel a lot. It is exhausting and it is not glamorous at all. Nope. And, you know, and now I have my own consulting company, and I just, you know, people always rag on influencers and people who've built these careers out of media, I'm like, they're getting free holidays in the Greek islands. And I'm here slogging away. I'm saying the same stuff over and over again. Like, I feel like at the moment I've upset someone in a past life, and my lot in life now is to explain why post go live support or hypercare is important over and over and over again for the rest of my life. So I'm just going, who did I piss off in my last life? But yeah. And I'm also thinking, do I want to do this for the next 25, 30 years or until I drop dead, whichever one comes first? Because yeah. And a lot of the things that you talked about are happening in Australia as well. Like, we've had some very big agile transformations happen. We've had one of our biggest banks and our biggest telco have just gone through them. But because of what's happening in the world at the moment, people are very reluctant to sign off on these major transformations. And so a lot of people who went through that, they might have been a project manager or a business analyst, and they went, oh, this agile thing's great. You know, I've had a fantastic time being a part of this. I want to be an agile coach now. They're struggling, right? So,
and I'm thinking to myself, because I talk about badly defined or ill-defined problems. The phrase we use in the book is ill-defined, but badly defined problems. And I'm asking myself, what do they actually mean by an agile transformation? What does this actually mean, that they've gone from being this type of organization to a completely different organization, or they've just learned some new tools and techniques and they're trying to use them? Or they've, you know, abandoned all the ways of working they used to do, and then now they're using these completely new ways of working, and they've completely transformed culturally, professionally, methodology-wise, and they're operating completely different. They've gone from being a traditional, you know, manufacturer to becoming, you know, the next Tesla, the next SpaceX, or whatever the sort of aspirational or expectation they have. But what they really mean is that a bunch of them have implemented a framework or a methodology based upon somebody else's ideas and teaching, usually a case study based approach, which is one of the big consultants that have come in with some glossy PowerPoint decks, trained everybody for a few million dollars, and then told everybody this is how work gets done. These people who've taught them have got no deep understanding of their context, their business, their customers, their problems, their complex organizational structures, their communication, and all this type of thing. But this is apparently how we'll solve all the world's problem and world hunger and world peace. And that's magically transformed you. The reality of it is, these companies have tried to implement some frameworks or some prescriptive models based upon some teaching, probably from people, as I say, don't have the deep expertise in their industry context, and they are calling that a transformation. That is not a transformation whatsoever. We're not turning gas stations into hospitals or manufacturers into banks. That's a transformation. What we're doing is we're evolving working practices, and we're transitioning, you know, legacy methods to more modern methods, and transitioning legacy technology to digital technology, because people don't want to be using typewriters and fax machines anymore. They want to be using some modern way of communicating. And that's what we're actually doing. It's not a transformation. It's just an evolution, a growth of how we do things. And then what we're finding is that a lot of these methods that have been bludgeoned in by these unqualified, in many cases, people, are unsuitable for purpose, because nobody actually defined what the problem was. What was the problem we were trying to solve? And so instead of spending time understanding what really was wrong, and as I've said in some of these keynotes, they focus on these things like customer attrition, employee attrition, costs are too high, revenue or profits are down, quality is not where it needs to be. And as I keep telling people, these are not problems. These are results or outcomes. These are a result of how you do the work. And so they spend all this money buying all this extra way of working and try to implement it, but the results aren't changing. And so it's not them. They've either got the wrong problem definition, or they're using the wrong tools. It's something called bounded applicability. They're using a hammer instead of a toothbrush and that type of thing. So they are now working and surviving in these problems that they don't really understand. And then we dig a little bit deeper. We actually find it's not a methodology problem at all. It's a behavior problem. Mm. We found that what happens is that people's attitudes, their approaches, their behaviors towards each other, towards the work, these silos, these towers of power, these empires that have been built by executives, these islands of disconnected effort, the communication, the collaboration, the cooperation, the conflict resolution across the organization, nobody's dealt with that. Scaled Agile framework, work, Scrum at scale, Less, Nexus, all these basic Scrum, whatever you want to call, Kanban, any of these words that are banded around it, and it's not really Kanban, but all these things that are banded around, they don't really do Kanban, by the way, but all these things that are banded around, they don't address the human factors aspect. They don't address communication, collaboration, team working, team learning. Yeah, and it's not building pasta sticks with marshmallows on top in a retrospective, because that's stupid. Mm. So it's none of those things, and they're not addressing that. And then they're announcing that Agile doesn't work here. And the problem is Agile at its core is a philosophy. It's just a manifesto of some principles and values. They're okay, they're good. It's just a philosophy, but it's not a methodology. And then they all go and teach some bloated version of Scrum as a methodology, and they say this will fix everything, or some, you know, bastardized version of what Spotify tried once and abandoned, and then McKinsey call it the Spotify method, and the rest is hit, yeah, and the same old nonsense. And so what we end up with is tools that don't work because they don't understand the problem, or the tools are used in the wrong context or in the wrong way. And we haven't actually addressed the underlying problems, which is, why do we have silos? Why don't we communicate? Why don't we collaborate? Why don't we flow value horizontally through the organization? Mm. And that's the problem with Agile today.
That was amazing. So
I went off there a bit.
It was good, but you actually answered the first few questions I was going to ask without me even having to ask the questions. But what I did want to say is, you talked about why transformations fail, but in your presentation at the World Agility Forum, one of the things that you said was that organizations aren't designed to enable change. As well as not being able to define their problem, they're not designed to enable change. So how does this contribute to the failure of agile transformations, or all transformations, and what can leaders do to ensure that they have and are enabling change across their organization?
So if we look at the scale of some organizations, most organizations are hierarchical. Mm-hmm. I mean, I deal in organizations with 20 to 50,000 people. So these are big things. Yeah. These are small countries, even cities. Mm. And physically, in the case of some, they're almost a city in their geographical dispersion and their physical size. So they tend to be very hierarchical, and they tend to be driven very much by instruction, call it command and control if you want. I don't mean that in a Victorian workhouse sense, but they are driven by, I make a decision, you guys just follow my instructions. And so any semblance of pulling genuinely from the customer and having pull systems, true Kanban systems, are really not feasible. But the way the MBAs are taught in business schools, the way the large consulting houses groom their bots, their automatons that they send into these businesses, the way that people are promoted into these positions, that's your Peter principle, these positions of it, you know, to their level of incompetency, you end up with
sometimes
a bunch of people
far above their level of incompetency.
So, I'm glad this
it's
is
not just one level visual. Sometimes.
So the thing is this, they get to a level where the leaders don't know how to do this. They don't know what to do. They don't know how to do it. So then they call up the mate at Deloitte or McKinsey or Accenture or Bain or BCG, or name one of your favorite big consulting houses, just to throw them all in the same bucket here. And they come in with their glossy PowerPoint decks. And actually, a relative of mine was a Deloitte bot for several years, and she admitted she was clueless and knew nothing. But she was trained how to use PowerPoint decks and to present things professionally, dressed extremely nicely and with great presentation skills, but she'd never actually ever done the job.
Yeah.
And so these are the people with the MBAs that are going in based upon some nonsense taught, Tayloristic type approaches taught in business schools and, you know, outdated, outmoded things like management by objective from Drucker. Drucker was a great guy, but some of his methods are outmoded now, and multiple other things taught in business schools. And they go in and they parrot this rhetoric in a nice case-based approach, which is a nice standardized, repeatable process. So very lean, just not very good. Mm. And then they sell this, and these companies outsource not just the responsibility, but the ownership, the accountability for the change to some company. And most of these executives are in the roles for 2 or 3 years max in the US, because then they're getting promoted sideways or they're moving on to another company.
Yeah.
So they're in it for the rapid gain in position or the rapid gain in equity, you know, because these folks get bonused extremely high.
Mm.
And then they exit to a different role. So there's never any sustainment of change. So these people are the people who are in charge of it. So they outsource and offload this to these big organizations. And then they don't empower the workforce. There's no true empowerment. There's no true psychological safety. There's no true metaphorical and on-cord where somebody in a knowledge work environment or an office environment — knowledge work's a horrible phrase, by the way, but it tends to be what they use, because apparently if you're not in that environment, you have no knowledge. That's the inference. But they put them into these organizations, and the people who really understand how things work never get the opportunity to change or affect change or to be able to alert to things that need to be changed. They just get told what the strategy is, driven by whoever they've hired to implement this strategy.
Yep.
And so this is not enabled for success. There is no change enablement here. And if you take the Toyota viewpoint — and Toyota has its own challenges, they're not beyond reproach — but the worker on the line has the power to stop the line. The worker on the line, yes, has the power to innovate, to be creative within Kaizen, new ideas. All the workers on the lines, every year, they spend time in doing something called JKK, Jikote Kanketsu, which is process improvement in simple words, but of the process that they own. And this is a certain thing they're taught and they're led through, and they have to make these approaches. They're all trained in problem solving. They're all trained in the various aspects that make a Kaizen culture live. And so a lot of value emerges from the workforce. But in most American corporates, and I guess Australian corporates and Europe the same, this doesn't happen. It's suppressed, pushed down. You do as you're told. And the managers — and the big evil, of course, in America is incentives. So the managers direct the workers based upon their incentives, not the workers' incentives, the managers' incentives. Mm-hmm. So they often direct people's energies to the wrong problems or the wrong work because they want to
get their bonus. Yeah.
And let me tell you, if you're earning $5 or $10 million a year, you don't have a problem.
Yeah.
So if I'm an executive earning $10, $20 million, I do not have a problem. And why should I change? Because my life's fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got — so this is what I mean by organizations aren't set up to change effectively. And it takes great leadership, being totally different construct to management or executive job titles, but takes great leadership and great participation and engagement of such of said leadership to actually create the environment for change to occur. True distributed leadership, true empowerment, true transfer of the ownership of decision-making to the people doing the work, for them to be able to affect change, and then create an environment where it's safe for them to experiment, safe for them to try things out, safe for them to fail within, you know, enabling constraints within those guardrails. But that's what it takes. And most organizations aren't interested in that. The 2-3 year VP is interested in just making some difference on a few KPIs, a few OKRs, so that they get their incentive, they get their bonus, they get their promotion, or they go and get themselves hired at the next company to do the same nonsense again there. And you see this all the time, because as Deloitte are there for 2 or 3 years, and suddenly, you know, McKinsey are in, or Bain are in, or BCG. Yeah. This rotating carousel of these folks.
Yeah.
And in big organizations, hell, they've got them all in there. Different divisions are using their own favorite supplier. Yeah. And then as the VP leaves or the CEO gets replaced or something, then they bring their favorite buddies with them. Mm-hmm. And this nonsense starts all over again. And I don't believe it's actually fixable. That's the problem. I don't think any of us are equipped to solve this, because the big consulting houses aren't incentivized to do anything other than earn big money and keep the paymasters happy.
Yeah.
And we collectively are all too small to be able to influence and change. It's like trying to change government, you know? It's like trying to tell Trump that he lost.
Yeah.
And so the thing is this, that it's impossible for us to affect the change. Now, we may nudge things in small pockets. We may have some small successes.
You might have a couple of advocates here and there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we get some job satisfaction and we make a bit of money. But will we ever fix it? No. It's too big a machine. It's like trying to fix politics, fix governments, fix, you know, global sort of geopolitical challenges. It is beyond our scope to do that unless we get ourselves into elected office or unless we become the CEO of these organizations, both which are extremely rare possibilities. And so part of my motivation now, and back to that earlier point, what advice would I give myself now? I'm starting to work a lot in Latin America, and I'm looking to do some work in South Africa, and I'm looking at creative ways that they can afford my charges by structuring it where a group of companies will get together to bring me over to work with them all, because my daily rate is my daily rate.
Yeah.
My team members' daily rates, their daily rates. So that can be shared to make a trip viable for my organization, but also for those people who need that expertise. But the difference I'm seeing in these countries, they ask for help, they listen, and then they try what you tell them to try. They don't argue with you because they truly want to evolve, truly want to change. And I was on a meeting earlier today with South America, with Argentina, and those people then, they have all sorts of challenges economically. They truly want to improve and change, and they're willing to try anything, and they want that outside expertise to help them. But I worry in a lot of these large organizations that you and I and others deal with, they are a lost cause. They are beyond salvation. And eventually some of them will fail or collapse. And then in a crisis, they'll bring us in and beg us to help them.
And you're like, well, there's not that much I can do now.
You're sort of screwed, you know.
Yeah.
So,
well, anyway. I can make it suck a bit less, but I can't stop this. Sorry.
No, you've gone too far. You know, you're the next Enron or whatever it happens to be, the next Blockbuster or Nokia or whoever it happens to be.
Kodak. Yep.
But anyway, all right. Sorry. Back to you.
There's a lot of good stuff there. So I have had several not-for-profit clients in the disability services sector in the last couple of years. And that's a sector in Australia that is undergoing a huge amount of change and disruption. And I have found, firstly, they're smaller organizations. So I've been working with their CEO, their executive leadership team, and in some cases their boards, which if you're, you know, for me, being a change manager or a change agent in one of these larger companies, like, and we do have some companies that have 50,000, 100,000 employees, there's a lot of levels between me and the C-suite, because usually I'm reporting into a program manager who's reporting into a PMO person who then reports in, you know, so there might be five levels between like a CTO or a CIO or wherever the transformation, you know, wherever the transformation is being led from.
Sure.
So I found what you found is that these organizations are small. They are being heavily disrupted. They're very aware. We don't have the capability to navigate change. We need help. And I've come in and I've had, like, it hasn't been the most financially lucrative work I've done because these people are for-purpose organizations and I don't charge them as much as I would a corporate. And there's I'm going to come back to that because there's an ironic story that the people who have the most money want to pay the least. Like, I don't want to pay you that. It's like, well, you're making billions of dollars. Anyway, but yeah, they've been listening and I have had some really rewarding experiences and they have appreciated me and my work. And I've had, you know, comments saying, oh, I haven't heard of that company, you know, because I've also got on my CV some of Australia's biggest corporates, which people find very impressive. But then those corporates are like, this is our methodology and you have to follow it. And it's really, really hard to shake things up. And, you know, like I have gotten in trouble a lot of times for trying to do things differently because people will say, oh, we like you, you're different, let's do it differently. I'm like, all right. And then it's like, oh, no, not like that. And I'm like, well, you know, every time I do what you're saying you like about me, I get told off.
You know, it's funny, but there's a couple of things that segue onto that. When I was in South Africa, I met some Australians, professors.
Yeah.
And I've got a lot of friends that are Australian, as I mentioned to you before we started recording today. I have some, you know, family in Oz because my grandparents emigrated there as the 10-pound Poms back in the 60s. So I've got some relatives that I've never seen, but I know that they're somewhere in Brizzy. Yeah. But the funny thing is the Aussies, And a lot of your listeners will throw things at the radio now or whatever, however they're listening to this thing, because they're closest to the Brits than the Brits themselves. Yeah. I mean, of all the English speaking nations, they're so close things.
Yeah.
And out of work and out of the office, they are some of the most crazy people and sort of, you know, outwardly. Yeah. You know what I'm saying here? Yeah. 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 Yeah, unpolitically correct people you could actually imagine. But in work, it's so controlled, it's so contrived, it's so rule-based, and you are so regulated as a country. I mean, one of the vlogs I watch talks, I mean, I just see how people, you can't breathe on the roads without a cop pulling you over for speeding or something. It's such a controlled society. Yet when you go into these organizations, as you say, and you find them so broken, they just can't get ahead of themselves by changing what's so broken. And I just find there's an irony in Australian sort of society where you've got these amazing people, the crazy mad people when they're out of work. But in work, you're so controlled in a way that everything's inappropriate and everything must be complied with in a certain way.
And it's all unspoken rules as well.
Yeah, and your government and regulation and stuff. But the one thing, just on the other thing I was going to say, is you find the people who do the hardest work get paid the worst.
Yeah.
The worst paid jobs, or the worst workers get paid the worst, the worst jobs get paid the worst amount of money, and the easier jobs get paid the most amount of money. And some of the, I went into a food processing facility in the last year and did some help to turn them around. They were having some challenges. And I spent all my time on the plant floor with some of my colleagues. And we did so much for the people who do the worst, just crappy job for crappy pay, for crappy hours in not great conditions. Not that they've been treated badly. It's not workhouse stuff, but it's just not a great job. And there's some have been there 40 years doing this, you know, packing frozen food and things. And so I spend a lot of time enabling a voice for those people, because they understand what it takes to keep that business running, and the management aren't listening to them.
Yeah.
Well, I can scale that to corporate level, these big 40, 50,000 person companies. The people in the C-suite have no idea what's happening down below.
And they think they know best. They think
And so I spend a lot of time making them go listen. But I now, and it's just me being arrogant, but I won't actually engage now with a company unless I'm talking to C-suite leaders, because I know I won't be able to achieve any change. It's pointless. I mean, I can earn money, but I'd rather earn money.
I wish I was in that position. I'm so jealous.
I know. And I'm sorry to those that aren't. But the reality of it is that the people who need our help the most can't afford it. Okay. But the people who can afford it, we don't want to help.
Yeah.
And that's the reality. So we have to go to the people who can afford to pay us, because we have to pay our bills.
Yeah.
But we'd much rather be with the people who can't afford to pay us, being NGOs, nonprofits, or just small businesses, and help them succeed, because they truly want the help and will truly listen. And you get some great relationships and great rapport. And I end up spending most of my time fighting battles in boardrooms with people that just want to argue about why they can't do what I'm saying they can't. And I have a phrase that I use that, you know, all complexity in organizations is human derived. And my test for that, because people talk about complex problems, and if they really understand what a complex problem is, go read Kinevin and West Churchman and things. But if you really understand that, if you take all the people away, is the problem still a complex problem? And and I tell you invariably, it's not.
Yeah.
It's the people that make the problems complex. And you work in change management, and this is the problem. Attitudes, behaviors, collaboration, communication, all these words. That's the thing. And culture emerges. It's a product of our behaviors, how we interact, how we act towards each other, towards the work. The way the environment we create is the emerging culture. And if you Google culture, it's the arts and institutions and things of an organization, a society. But so it's the way we behave, the way we act, that creates the culture and the environment. So when you go into organizations, they say, we don't like our culture, we want this continuous improvement culture.
Yeah.
Well, then you're going to have to change how you behave, because it's your behaviors and the way you act that has created the culture you have, the lack of communication, the silos, the conflict, the them and us, the pointing fingers in multiple directions, the blame culture, the fear culture. All these are behavioral. So we need to change the behaviors. And there are methods and techniques, not this nonsense from Orsk and these pseudoscience nonsense that people waste the money getting certificates in, but actually teaching people how to collaborate and communicate, how to work together as a team, Because most of these people go and tell you, oh, Tuckman model, you know, forming, norming, storming, performing, whatever. Yeah. But how do we actually do that? Nobody actually teaches you the how of doing it. And you don't need couples counseling repurposed into business where we all sort of learn to love each other. It's none of that nonsense. There are proper structured ways of enabling people to communicate more effectively, collaborate, like turn your bloody webcam on when you're in a meeting. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, unless you've got some, you know, real need for us to support a specific need, then turn your bloody webcam on and actually learn to be friends with each other, collaborate with people effectively, and be open, be honest, to be transparent. But if we want to create an environment where people can be open and transparent, we've got to remove the fear of them being open and transparent. All this is behavior. All of this is behavioral.
Yeah. Yeah. A couple of points I wanted to touch on. So one thing I've thought for a long time, and I've never mentioned this on the podcast, is, you know, how there's the whole AI is coming for our jobs. And I think it, you know, that AI is definitely something we should be thinking about. But I've always thought they should be taking the executives' jobs because they get paid the most. And all they do is make decisions. And they usually make those decisions badly and they dither and they argue. And if we're talking about a, like, it's never going to happen because those people would have to give up their power. And they all go, oh, let's take the jobs of the people, but they're the people who get paid the least, right? Who actually do the hardest work. So I have thought probably that one of the most redundant jobs, if we're thinking about AI and, you know, data-driven decision-making, because that's what executives are supposed to be doing, is making the correct decisions. And so, go.
So there's a concept called...
But please hire me, executives.
And so there's a concept called Jidoka. It comes from the early teachings of Toyota. It was the first major principle that was created by its founder. And in the simple word actually translates to automation in English, but then they tweaked it and twiddled it a bit. And it was actually John Shook that came up with the English version, autonomation. But Toyota will talk about automation with the human touch. Or machine intelligence with a human touch. And so the idea behind this is we want to give the machines sufficient decision-making power so that the humans don't have to waste their time monitoring machines and making those decisions, and we can redeploy their knowledge and skills to higher level thinking tasks and opportunities. So that's the basic concept. There's more to it than that, but at a very high level for this podcast, that's sufficient. And it's defined in much more detail in the new book for anybody who wants to go buy the book. But no, I mean, from that point of view, it is one of the underlying principles of Toyota's production system, along with just in time and various other things. So imagine now artificial intelligence, and there is a definition I have, but just high level, it's defined as machines thinking and acting like humans. Okay, there's some nuances in there. So if we get to a point where the machines are thinking and acting like humans, the decision-making authority that you're describing, that gives them some form of control. So now we're giving these machines, these computers, these systems control, hey, fast forward quantum computing and all the rest of it. We're giving them some control. But what stops them making bad decisions just really quickly? So machines, these computerized machines, AI, whatever, your machine learning, they can learn from these large learning models by making lots of bad decisions or lots of decisions or making and guessing and eventually filtering what they think is the most efficient or most effective decision or hopefully the correct decision, whether it's in safety or healthcare or in autonomous driving or now in decision making in companies. So then we start to think, well, okay, how did we seed the learning models? What did we give them as a starter for 10? Because when you turn them on, they're dumb. So they need input. If you remember the old movie Short Circuit with Johnny Five, his favorite phrase was, need input, Stephanie, you know, and he wanted more input from the outside world because he'd become a self-aware. And now he needed to learn so he could make decisions and understand. So we have to seed these learning models. Now the experts out there, much bigger experts than me, the data scientists, the ML programmers, developers, will tell me these all sorts of checks and balances and question techniques to prevent them doing bad things. But if we seed these large learning models, which are underlying part of what we call AI, with what we believe today, so these same people in these same roles get the developers to teach the AI the things that they decide and make decisions on now based upon their range or of skills, knowledge, abilities, or their sort of external, their what they call their worldview, their external inputs and triggers, then we're teaching the AI to think like them. And what we want the AI to do isn't to not think like them. We want it to think better than them. So now we've got a bad
trained
master.
AIs to be
we've
the
now
same.
We've now trained a hyper intelligent version of what we are, which is not what we want. We need something better. So I don't know how to solve that problem. And then that becomes a risk where you connect it to the internet and the bad actors then let it read everything on the internet. Mm. So you people in North Korea and other bad actor states, they teach the AI that we're all evil and should be annihilated. And we are the bad people. And then you connect them to physical interfaces. And then you get Skynet when it decides to nuke the USA because they think we're all bad because the North Koreans taught the AI were bad. Mm. And now the replacement for Kim Jong-un or whatever his name is an AI who makes the decision that let's nuke all these people who don't agree with us. So that's the extreme end. But go Google. I have an article, but I can't show it on the podcast. But in the Ukraine, they've got first-person drones that are hunting Russian soldiers and making kill decisions autonomously. So we're actually into Skynet territory already. And it's not much of a decision leap. We've got fully automated drones that can fly themselves and release weapons themselves. The next step is to actually let the drone make the decision about when to attack. Now you've got Skynet. Now you've got Terminator 2 or whatever you want to call it. So that's the danger. That's the ethical dilemma there. But these leaders that are building these things, some of them will be thinking of that. Because if I'm waffling about it as an idiot, you can imagine some other people who are a little bit not idiot like me are actually thinking about it for real. And then so we start to worry. Now, back at the company level, the most implementation of AI I'm seeing at the moment is cost reduction. And cost reduction means removing humans because basic admin chores, basic warehouse. I mean, a lot of the warehouses are fully automated now. Whether you must be 300 people, there's three or four people running these gigantic Amazon warehouses and the machines are doing all the work. So you only need two or three people. That's the concept of Jidoka, by the way. You get the machines doing all this work. So only two or three people need to monitor the entire system rather than one person for every step in the process or one person for every machine, which was in the original days. So if you see that in the supermarket, when you go to check out, the automatic, the self-scanning checkouts, because they hate now in America, that's Jidoka in action. You've got one operator looking at six registers. In case there's a problem, the and-on light goes on, the red light that says, need operator, and the operator
unexpected item in bagging area
is that what they call it there? So
that's
Jidoka. That's what Jidoka is. But now we're moving this to the next level where we're going to have trucks, big 18-wheel trucks running the interstates in the US from a point of dispatch to a point of reception without drivers, fully automated. Because on a relatively straight road, it's relatively easy to have that level of autonomous control on a vehicle. The good news is they'll all sit on the inside lane at a steady speed, not block the lanes when we want to get past the damn bastards. We won't move over. But these things will now be trunking on these giant interstates. So all these lorry drivers, these truck drivers are going to lose jobs. These warehouse workers, these people in basic admin roles, some of the companies I won't mention I'm working with are using these to automate call centers now. So not just the horrible chatbots and the voice recognition nonsense when you call your airline, but removing humans. If you try and call UPS in this country, it's almost impossible to reach a human. You get voice bots or chatbots, and you cannot get a human response. And so you're just in the lap of whatever service they want to deliver. But eventually, what are we going to do with all these people?
Yeah.
What about when all the make banking decision? I went to Chase a few months ago and talked to them about lines of credit for business expansion. They can't make any decisions anymore. It's all now centralized and all computerized. So the computers make the decisions based upon all these data parameters. They've farmed all this data about you and they make decisions. The human is no longer involved in the decision making. There's no human bank manager relationship and override of this. So we're gradually eliminating the need for people to make decisions and do work. And so then what are we going to do with all this unemployed? What are we going to do with this population expansion that we're currently in? We're 8 billion heading towards 10 billion. Yeah. Don't have food production for all these people. Yeah. Then you can start to, and I'm going to scare everybody now just for a bit of fun. Then you get, and this is not me being a stupid right-wing conspiracy, it's just me having a bit of fun. I used to read a lot of H.G. Wells and Isaac Asimov as a kid, sci-fi. But, you know, we all love The Matrix. Well, the first movie, the others were terrible, but we all love the first movie, The Matrix. What happens when the machines decide that we're waste, we're muda, we're non-value added activity, and it decides to kill us off and or uses as biological food to feed the machines that they are now creating? So there's a bit of fun for you, for the listeners to go off and say, this bloke's bonkers.
No. It's all, I think it's what everyone's thinking about. I would love to talk to you all day, but I know that we both have work that we need to do and clients pay the bills, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's the thing.
So where can people get more Nigel? Where can they get your book? Do you have any upcoming speaking engagements that you wanted to share?
So the book's on Amazon, of course. That's the best source. It's on Amazon in Oz, I've checked. And
the print is definitely there.
Yeah, and they print it in Australia as well. So it's Australian jobs as well, which is good. But nigelthurlow.com if they want to get a launching point for me. And I have a link tree as well. But if they go to nigelthurlow.com, they'll get all that. Speaking-wise, I'm already getting booked for next year. So definitely going to be in Italy and Portugal next year, again at the World Agility Forum.
Oh, cool.
There's going to be a great event in Italy. I am desperate to come over to Oz. People keep asking me. I mentioned to you earlier, people keep asking me in Melbourne to come over to Oz. If there's somebody thinks there's some value in having me over there, do some training, do some events, do some stuff, then get in touch and let's see if we can bring some of this witticism and nonsense to Oz. It'd be a great deal of fun.
Yeah, I know. We didn't even get into the bullshit jobs, which was the most hilarious part of your talk.
That's the next podcast, Tash, because if the listeners give this good feedback, we'll do one specifically on bullshit jobs. And what we're talking about here is fake agile.
Yeah.
And most Scrum Master and Agile Coach roles that have been created are bullshit, not because of the people who are in the roles, but because of the lack of adoption of the roles and how they're supposed to function within organizations. That's a teaser, a spoiler for podcast two.
Yes. Yes, let's do it. That would be amazing because I've had such a fabulous time talking with you. Thank you so much for generously sharing all of your knowledge, all of your experiences. And for the listeners, if you listen on Apple Podcasts, write a review. This is almost the end of season 8, but not quite. I've got a few more episodes left and we'll be back soon. Nigel, thank you so much.
Hey, no, that's great. And, you know, talking to you is just like being on Triple J, and I do listen to Triple J podcasts. It's awesome.